One begins the eternal learning curve. The more you know, the more you realize you have more to learn.
At the end of the day, you can be as good as gold, but if you don't have passion for wine, no matter how good you are, it isn't going to work.
And Mother Nature is your partner all the way until it's done.
Whereas the U.S., you go into a big grocery store and you have 2,000 different glass bottles full of wine.
My father told me, never work for money, work to accomplish something. Making money is the result of doing something right.
The bottom line is, it's all about the soil.
Well, the results are really the benefit of our doing our homework.
What makes winemaking so interesting and fascinating is that every single year it's been different.
There was definitely a sense that we were all sort of in a pioneering endeavor. It was fun.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle and welcome to podcast number 119. This week, we feature Kathleen Inman of Inman Family Wines in Sonoma.
Winemakers are often referred to as rock stars. Well, that's not surprising, considering winemakers spend a fantastic amount of time on the road doing various dates for tastings, wine dinners, and general appearances. So I guess that makes Kathleen Inman a rock star, because we caught up with her on the road in Chicago to talk about Inman Family Wines. No roadie, no stage crew, just a full schedule ahead and a day of lovely wine. So here we are in downtown Chicago, and I'm here with Kathleen Inman of Inman Family Wines. Thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you for coming to talk with me.
Not at all. My pleasure. It's fun to come talk to winemakers.
Really? Why is that?
I don't know. It's something about what you do. You bring joy to people. You make people happy. You make me happy.
Well, that's good. That's good. It's not always what people think, though. You know, it's a lot of cleaning and moving heavy stuff around and drinking beer.
Yeah, they say. Go ahead, you can say it.
Yeah, it takes a lot of great beer to make great wine. And there's actually one of my favorite beers at harvest time from the Russian River Brewing Company has that exact name.
It's called?
It takes a lot of great beer to make great wine. It's a pretty big, there's a lot of words on it. But anyway, Vinny makes some great beer, and that's a really refreshing beer at harvest time.
Yeah, I bet you need that too. Boy, after being out there, and especially in the heat, depending on
And you're tasting a lot of sweet stuff. Grapes, wine grapes are very different than table grapes. And unless people have been out to a vineyard just before harvest, I think they don't always realize how very sweet the fruit is. And so you spend the few weeks before you actually make a decision to pick tasting these grapes. And, you know, when you have, like I do, maybe half a dozen vineyards you're checking, every day you're eating a lot of grapes. In fact, I have at my vineyard some 1930s table grapes, some very old vines, and they come ripe just after all of my Pinot Noir comes ripe. And the funny thing is, I never want to eat them because I've eaten so many grapes and they just rot on the vine, which people are like, how come you're not eating these? They're delicious. It's like, grapes? No, thank you.
It's funny to think about you having table grapes.
Yeah. Well, they were there, the property that I have. Basically, I should say I have 10 and a half acres in Sonoma County's Russian River Valley that I farm organically. And I bought that land in 1999 and put the vineyard in 2000. But the property had actually been a winery and a vineyard as early as 1883. And so the property that I bought was the last 10 and a half acres of a very large ranch. And so in addition to having wine grapes, they had prunes and pears and apples. And then they had table grapes and walnuts. And so I have quite a diverse set of, you know, older trees and things that aren't just my Pinot Noir vineyard.
After your 10 and a half acres, and you also lease that, I'm assuming.
So yes, so I have some other vineyards that I have contracts on for designated sections of the vineyard for Pinot Noir and for Chardonnay.
Is everything Russian River, or is it?
Everything I've been doing is Russian River. I have a secret little new project that is a little bit of Dry Creek Zinfandel, and I'm looking for a few other little things, but it won't be under my Inman label. It'll be a little bit of a different thing, just something fun. I like to, you know, keep it fresh and try new things.
That sounds like a great idea. Well, Zinfandel out that way, I mean, that just is a natural
match, isn't it? Yeah. Exactly. And I'm interested in doing a little Grenache and a little Carignan and maybe even finding some Chenin Blanc. I think that would be fun.
Not a lot of people doing Carignan, and
no.
Certainly not Chenin Blanc.
Exactly. Oh. So those are things I'd like to play with.
You were asking me about how I got into this. Now my turn. So how did you become a winemaker?
Well, I was saying I grew up in the Napa Valley, and my parents grew up in the Napa Valley. My grandparents did. In fact, I have relatives on one side that were in Sonoma County as early as 1869, right? Wow. After the Civil War. And then on my other side of the family, some in Sonoma County in the 1840s. I've been there a long time, but my family was not involved in the wine industry at all. My great-grandfather farmed prunes.
So he's a farmer, though.
Yes, absolutely. So I grew up helping my grandma in the garden and the orchard, and I love growing things. That's really my passion. We were talking earlier about the importance of passion in successful business, and for me, my passion is growing things, and I've always loved cooking and making things from the produce I grew, and wine is no different, really. I have a big vegetable garden, and it's pretty cool that I can put on a meal where I've grown the produce as well as the wine.
Well, don't the French say wine is food, right?
So, I agree. Yeah. I think it is, yeah. And in fact, I try. My personal preference is for wines that have nice, bright acidity that go well with food and that have generally lower alcohol so that, again, they don't overwhelm the food and that you can have lots of different wines without having the alcohol effects ruin the meal.
I love it when I get to hear winemakers talk about the lower alcohol.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've been... My first vintage was 2002, and making balanced wines have been... I think it's probably everyone's goal, and maybe balance and beauty are in the eye of the beholder. But my current Chardonnay is 11.6% alcohol, which is rather unusual for California. My current Pinot Noir is 12.5. So, wow. And that's done without adding any water or acid or removing any alcohol, which there are an awful lot of wines that have those things, going on.
So you're all about sustainable farming.
I am.
That's great.
I am. And that's not just something I started recently. I've actually, always been an organic gardener at home and very interested in recycling since I was a kid. And that's nowadays something that's sort of, woven in the fiber of my business. I call it my eco-ethics. So besides organic farming, my entire winery is made out of recycled materials, practically. The steel is recycled automobiles. It's all solar powered. All my wastewater is reprocessed and, reused. I repurposed the old barn that I took down to build all the furniture and bar and the tasting room. And, it's... Basically everything. If we had some of my bottles here, they're lighter weight, made out of recycled glass and made in California, not in China. So their carbon footprint is less, but they also keep jobs in our country, which all of these things I think are, part of sustainability.
This is something that's not unusual to wine country. A lot of winemakers have gone to this idea of recycling structures like barns as well as their water, that kind of a thing. And certainly solar power.
Yes, I think a lot have. I'm not sure there are very many that have done it quite...
Maybe not as extensively as
extensive.
You've done.
I mean, literally every aspect of our... Everything I could do to make it the greenest project that I could. But I think it's great. I mean, Sonoma County actually has a goal of having every single producer be... sustainable, and we're setting some goals to make that happen and programs to help bring other producers in line with that. So that's kind of exciting that if we do, it will be the only growing area that has, well, right now we're the only one who's set such ambitious goals. But I've forgotten already because, 22 nights away from home in the last 30? I'm a girl on the go.
Well, that's what it takes. You know, this goes back to this idea of the romance of owning a winery. Again, living exactly. out of a suitcase. This is a tough gig.
Well, I mean, this is only one. I only get to do this marketing piece a short time of the year because the vineyard needs me. And in fact, this year it's gone on a little bit longer than my travels have gone on a little longer. And I've had to delegate my compost tea brewing for this cycle to someone else. I started the cycle, but I had to train someone to take over and do the next... five batches. I brew compost tea for the vineyard at Bud Break, which we've just had, and Bloom, which will be coming up in a couple of weeks. I'll have to do it again. And then at Set, when the little grapes are finally pollinized and are showing, I put another batch on.
So since you're doing the tea, are you fully biodynamic then? Or?
Well, biodynamic is a sort of trademarked term, and I'm not. But I do follow the lunar calendar for when I decide to prune. I use it for guidance for composting and shoot thinning and things that I do in the vineyard. And often at harvest, I pay a lot of attention to the moon cycles because I find that the sugar levels change just after a full moon. So in order to get ripeness but not as high alcohol, sometimes I will choose to pick immediately before the full moon if, you know, because that can have an impact.
The whole thing is fascinating to me. I go back to one of our earliest interviews with Behringer a number of years ago, and we've talked to so many wineries that are doing this. And again, the whole idea is not only just good for the earth, it's good for the wine. It's good for what you're making.
Exactly, exactly. And, you know, I mean, everything is in... There's a harmony to the universe, and I think... You know, sometimes people sort of poo-poo the idea that, you know, the moon and the stars have an impact. And I'm not either an astronomer or an astrologer. I don't really know about the constellations, but there are people who do, and they create calendars, and I've followed them, and I really get incredible results in my vineyard. And I think when I compare sometimes to those of the vineyards near me, my fruit tends to be, you know... stronger, more resistant to the mildew and sort of pressures that we have because the Russian River with the fog is a moist area, and my plants seem to do better in the tough years and tend to have very good yields and ripeness at, you know, lower sugars, which fits my winemaking style. And, you know, I think that it all is a result of these somewhat unconventional ideas that I have.
Well, it's proven to work, and if it works, that's
exactly.
great.
Exactly. Don't question it. If it's working, just do it. And that's kind of how the people who help me with some of my farming things, like the guys that come in and help me prune, because I have 13,500 vines. It's a lot for me. If I would not be able to do them all in a timely manner. And at first, they were like, doesn't really matter if we don't finish. And I'm like, yeah, can we just try? And after a few years, they realize, wow, this property is a bit different than some of the others we farm. And so they're very respectful now of my decisions.
That's nice.
Yeah. Wow.
And how many cases are you doing, by the way?
Just short of 5,000 cases. And so the wines are available across the country, quite a few, I mean, in the majority of markets through Broadbent Selections is a import company that actually represents me everywhere. And so they hook me up with their distributors. And so that's part of my travels of why I'm here in Chicago. I've been working with our wholesaler here and my regional manager going around to restaurants and wine shops, but mostly restaurants, and training staff on when they have the wine on their list so that they know a bit more about it and tasting them on them, and then also finding new accounts. So it's been quite exciting.
This is the best thing for wine lovers, for people like me, to know that you're out there talking to servers, talking to restaurant people, to educate them. That's such a big deal. It's serving, it's understanding what they're tasting and how they can recommend a great wine.
Exactly. I mean, and you know, and sometimes I'm doing that because I love to cook. So, you know, when I was in Philadelphia and I was doing a training at Smith and Wolensky, I was talking to them about, you know, the sorts of, you know, dishes I think go well with my wine. And, you know, it isn't just about, and yes, they go well with steaks, but, you know, talking about how wonderful Pinot Noir is with salmon or with scallops, and how adding beets or spinach, those earthier vegetables as sides, really bring out a lot of flavors in the Pinot.
And you're not only making Pinot, you're
I make a little bit of Pinot Gris. I have just 1,000 Pinot Gris vines, so that's a sort of specialist lot for me, between 150 and 200 cases of Pinot Gris. I make about 600 cases of Chardonnay, and that's been a fairly new project for me, but one that has got a lot of critical acclaim recently, so that's pretty cool. And then right now, my sort of hottest product is my Endless Crush Rosé of Pinot Noir. And that is a rosé, an intentional rosé, and people say, well, aren't, if you're making wine, isn't it all intentional? But so most rosés are made as a byproduct of red wine production. And so people actually pick the grapes to be a red wine, take some of the juice off, and before the skins have had a chance to color it fully, and that's a rosé. But often when it's picked for red wine, it means you have to add some water to lower the alcohol a little, or else you have a rosé that puts you to sleep on the sun lounger in the garden instead of helping you have fun conversation. And also, usually the acid is a little bit lower, because for red wines, the acidity is a little bit lower than a white wine. And so they end up having to acidulate, whereas I pick to be a rosé. And so the other, you know, the acid is just right when you're picking. And also, you are pressing the whole grape. So in the case of most of those bleed-off rosés, you're not getting all of the grape in the wine. You're just getting some of the free-run juice. And there's a lot more complexity in a rosé that's pressed. So I started making that in 2004 when it was actually kind of an accidental thing. I forgot it was my wedding anniversary, which is September 1st, and I called it as a harvest day. And my poor husband got up in the morning, happy anniversary, as we were going to go off to pick grapes, and I had nothing. And so I said, let me make a special wine today. And so I made just 70 cases of a wine, and we called it Endless Crush. We love double entendre in our family. And so, and puns, but that's a different story. And so I made that wine and we shared it with friends, and people were like, you have to make more of this. So I started just making it every other year, and it's become so popular that I've had to increase the production every year. And we've just released one for the first time 2 years in a row. So there's a 2013 Endless Crush, and that's what I've been showing a lot of people around Chicago, and there's some in Milwaukee as well, and also in Minneapolis. There's this whole area. There's a lot of Endless Crush going on.
I love this idea of this, but more importantly, what a beautiful compliment to your husband to make a wine for him. Gift.
I know. Well, my husband is very wonderful. He has his own business. People always think it's kind of odd when you're a woman winemaker and you have a business that you call family. So I called it Immen Family in the hope of free child labor, but free and children don't always go together. But my husband has his own business, but he'll come and help me. Like, he's flown in yesterday to help me with Pinot Days, which we're doing at Navy Pier today. And people always ask him the technical questions about the wine, which is kind of interesting that and he has to say, oh no, my wife's the winemaker, I'm just the trophy husband.
Nice.
Since he's British, he's got, you know, a very charming
he's British, is he? Where's
he from? Is from Yorkshire.
Oh, no kidding. Cool. Very
nice. So yeah, I actually lived in England for nearly 16 years.
Oh wow.
He met me. It's kind of a romantic story, if
sure,
you want to hear
I'm all
it.
Up for it.
Kind of follows on from the Endless Crush thing. Yeah, I met him when I worked first in a winery in the Napa Valley, when I was still a student at university. So yeah, so I met him when I was working at my very first winery job in the Napa Valley. And on the first day I was there, this Englishman and Englishwoman and American guy, three people came in, and I helped them, poured some wine for them, and was telling them a bit about the property. So anyway, he came in on the first day that I was there, and I mentioned I was going to be an exchange student in England the next year, just as an aside, and told them about the property that I was working at. And when they bought some wine, went away, I really didn't think of them again until 2 weeks later when the owner said, "You must have impressed some Englishmen. There's a letter here for you." Because, yes, in the old days, people used to write letters.
What's a letter?
I know. And it was, you know, there was no texts and no faxes and no internet. And this letter came for the owner of the winery. You know, "Dear sir, please forward the enclosed letter to the blonde assistant." And inside the letter just said, "Dear question mark." Not easy writing to a girl with no name. And so he and I became pen pals. Nice. And we wrote to each other for about a year. And I went to study in London, and we dated. And this year we've been married 30 years.
Oh, my God.
So
congratulations.
Yeah. And so we came back to... So I had a different career in the UK. And but as I said earlier, gardening was always my passion, and wine was one of our interests. And so we had a cellar, but I wouldn't say I was, you know, a sort of uber wine geek in those days. I didn't feel the need to notate everything. I'm more of a hedonist. I just enjoy. And we would, you know, travel to home to the Napa Valley. But we'd also travel, you know, throughout France. And we have friends in Burgundy. So we spent a lot of time there. And then in 1997, I guess it was, we were having a family holiday in Sonoma and Napa. And we had this harebrained idea that maybe we should go back, that we should move there, and that I could go back to making wine and try my hand at growing grapes instead of just all the vegetables and exotic plants I was growing in England. And that was what we did in 98. And here we are. We've been back just over 15 years. And, you know, I built this small business from 70 cases in 2002 to now just short of 5,000. Initially all estate fruit, but now I'm buying from a few other well-regarded farmers, and it's been quite an adventure.
I'll bet it has. I'm a little curious, just as a side note, the weather for him over here versus there. I mean, he's...
Well, so the first 18 months he kept saying, "It's another day in paradise."
And you also do a sparkling wine.
Yes, yes. So I'm a big fan of champagnes, and obviously I'm not in Champagne. I'm in the Russian River Valley in Sonoma, but I do grow Pinot Noir, and I decided in 2009 to try my hand at making a sparkling. And by the time it came out in 2011, I was like, wow, I should have been making this every year. It's delicious. And so I've just released a new sparkling, the 2012 Brut Rosé, and I'll have a Blanc de Noir coming out from the same vintage in about 18 months. I'm leaving it to stay on the yeast a bit longer.
Is it difficult for you as a winemaker, especially being a smaller winery, doing both? I mean, does that kind of...
Well, so we are very fortunate where I'm based. There is a facility that has all of the equipment you need, because you need a lot of very expensive specialized equipment for sparkling production. And so I've been able to take my grapes up to their facility and use their equipment and still be the winemaker, but not have to own all the equipment. And so that's been wonderful. And they were up in Hopland, California, but they're just moving down to Healdsburg, which is where I live. So it was quite difficult the first years, because sparkling wine you pick first. And so checking all the vineyards, like I was saying, it's a lot of walking around and tasting all the grapes. But once you start picking and making wine, you still have some vineyards that have the grapes that aren't ready. So I'd have to drive up to Hopland, check on my fermentations, drive down to the southern part of the Russian River to check on another vineyard, and then back.
That's a lot of driving
and then,
up there.
Yes, you feel sort of like one of those performers with the spinning plates, and You get them all going, and by the time you get to the end, the first one's wobbly, and you've got to start all over again. There's a lot of that.
Do you have a tasting room?
I do have a tasting room. It is open Thursday to Monday, 11 to 4, but then we also do appointments. It's a very small tasting room, but we like having people that are in the area stop by. You know, we usually have tasting the single vineyard Pinots, and not always the sparkling. It usually takes a verbal arm twisting for me to actually open a bottle for someone. But
take note, verbal arm twisting.
Exactly. Any excuse, really. but it's not ever on the menu. We don't, as a rule, taste it because it is a little expensive to have that to make it and to share it. But I love sharing. It's in my nature.
I think that's very indicative of wine, wouldn't you say?
Yes. I mean, I really do believe that wine is, you know, is a complement to good conversation and friends. And we have made so many fantastic friends since we started in this business. Wine is a wonderful thing for bringing people together, not just in the making of it, but in the sharing of it.
I completely agree. And for our listeners who would like to learn a little bit more about Inman Family Wines, how would they do that on the web?
Right. Well, our website has a lot of information about us. It's InmanFamilyWines.com. And then we do a lot of social media. So we're obviously Inman Family Wines on Facebook. And I'm Pinot Maven on Twitter, but I also have Inman Family Wine. And so, yeah, there's a lot of Pinterest pages and, you know, Instagram. We're all over the place.
And what's really cool about small wineries is you can call there and maybe half the time actually get the winemaker on the phone so you can ask questions right to the source, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I usually am the person. Sometimes people are surprised that I only have one full-time employee, so it's either going to be myself or Michelle. Yeah, people can call in at 707-293-9576.
That's fabulous. Kathleen, I know you got a busy day. You're going to be off to Pinot Fest very shortly, and I want to say thanks very much for
meeting. Thank you so much. It's been lovely chatting with you.
Learn more about Kathleen at InmanFamilyWines.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Original music by Tim Turton. Our intern is Alex McLean. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2014.